We're going to switch up a little bit from what y'all are typically hearing. I was asked to speak at SPATS, and I asked Natalie, hey, what do y'all want me to talk about? And she said it was up to me. So I had to scratch my head a little bit and asked her again for a little bit of advice. What do people want to hear? I'm sure y'all get knees, shoulders, ankles, all that kind of stuff over and over and over again. I figured some of the skin problems that athletes may come across may be something that isn't hit up very frequently. So it's going to be hard for me to point at the slides from here, but I'll do my best. It's after lunch. There's some pictures in here that have a little bit of blood, a little bit of infection, a little bit of fun stuff. So I don't anticipate any of the athletic trainers getting too queasy, but just in case, here's your forewarning. Nothing to disclose. I don't have any financial obligations to anything, objectives. We'll start off with a little bit of definitions. These are some of the things that I may, or words that I may use to describe some of the lesions that we will be seeing. A macule is a flat, non-raised lesion that is less than 1 centimeter across. If it's any bigger than that, we'll refer to it as a patch. A papule is pretty similar, except it's going to be a raised lesion, about 1 centimeter or less. Anything bigger than that will be a plaque. A nodule is a rounded elevation, usually greater than 1 centimeter, and tumors are large nodules. So again, we'll be referring to some of the things that we're seeing with some of this terminology. Moving on, vesicles, basically a fluid-filled lesion, usually smaller than 1 centimeter. Anything bigger than that will be described as a bulla or bulle. And pustules are very similar to vesicles, but instead of the serous fluid, they will have pus inside. Wheals, we think of firm edematous, meaning swollen plaques that usually come and go. They're transient in nature. Pruritic is something described as that's very itchy. And then serous fluid, obviously, is clear and yellow. Sanguineous is bloody. You may hear serous sanguineous fluid, which is a mixture of both. So just some of the terminology we'll be using through our presentation today. Real brief, some skin anatomy here. We've got the epidermis, or you got your skin right here. If you've seen a full thickness injury, the whole thing that you see that's cut is, and that's hard to see this laser pointer, but that's okay. The top part is the epidermis. It lies right on top of the dermis, and the dermis and epidermis combined are basically what you see as your skin. I make that designation because here in a little bit you'll see there's some of the differences in the injuries. Below the dermis you have the fatty tissue layer, and we'll get into that in a little bit. So etiologies of injury. There's different types of injuries. Skin is a natural protective barrier to several different forces. You have the mechanical forces, such as friction, traction, any kind of compression, impact, those types of things. You have environmental injury, like maybe somebody or some of the athletic trainers here this weekend may have some thermal injuries, some radiation from the sun, and then some infectious injuries as well, bacterial infections, viral infections, and fungal infections. So moving along, we'll start with the mechanical category. And we'll start with abrasions. These are pretty plain and simple. I think we see these very, very commonly, known as rug burns, strawberries, road rash. Anytime that you usually come into contact with a synthetic surface, and that's where the epidermal layer is removed. You still have an intact dermis, so you really don't have to do much with these. You just clean them up, debride them, clear out any gravel, pieces of track, anything that can get stuck in there, clean them out. Apply a topical antibiotic, cover them up, and they're usually pretty good to go after that. Again, anytime you have an injury dealing with blood, you worry about the bloodborne pathogens and making sure that they have an occlusive dressing before you return them to play. But other than that, they're good to go. Once you go through both the epidermis and the dermis, that's when you move from an abrasion into a laceration. So in the laceration there on the top, you can see that it's gone through both layers, and you see that yellow. It may be able to see it on these slides, but you can see that there's the fatty tissue underneath. Those kind of injuries will need to be closed. Those are usually done, obviously, after anesthesia. You're going to want to anesthetize these. Usually use lidocaine injection. That'll be done either in the training room or in a physician's office. And cleaning the wounds. You don't want to use stuff like iodine that can, although it will clean it, it can actually prevent the wound from healing. So you would just want to use some sterile saline. Once it's cleaned, you can close it after anesthetizing, usually either sutures, which you can see there in the picture on the bottom, or you can use some Steri-Strips with benzoin if it's going to be something that's very quick. So you can either do intermediately doing Steri-Strips during a game until you get to halftime, and then at halftime you can do definitive closure with sutures. Once the wound is closed, the athlete can return to competition again, as long as it's covered, there's no bleeding, all that good stuff. Next is acne mechanica. Basically, it's the same old acne as everybody gets as teenagers, but this is more from occlusive obstruction of the hair follicles. You see it very commonly in sports where they're wearing pads, helmets, where the chin straps are rubbing, the ear pads are rubbing, anything that's coming into contact with the skin. And it basically looks and behaves just like regular acne. In order to prevent these, I should say, you can look at cleaning the equipment. Now, it's not going to be cleaning it every day. Obviously, you're not going to clean all of the football equipment every day, but keeping them clean relatively, making sure that the athletes can wear either something in between the padding that's rubbing up against the skin that will wick moisture, keep that away from the skin, and then obviously good hygiene after coming into contact with that. Once they've already got it, we usually use a keratolytic ointment. Basically what that is it's a very mild form of acid that'll kind of take off the top layer of skin and let these drain out. You can use benzoyl peroxide, those types of things. Those are over-the-counter. And then there's also some prescription strength keratolytic agents. If that doesn't work, then we can move on to creams with antibiotics. And that will usually clear things up. If it gets really bad, then we may go into things, again, this would be referral to dermatology, getting them on medications like Accutane and the really high potency stuff that have a lot of other risks attached to them. Next, athletic nodules. These are usually fibrous connective tissue. If we think of fibrous tissue, it's more like scar tissue from repetitive pressure, friction. We see them commonly in combat athletes, people that are using boxing gloves, punching, those types of things. We'll get these mostly on the knuckles, bony prominences. You can see them sometimes in surfing where they're rubbing their knees on the surfboard as they're jumping up, getting on the board, or in skaters, runners on the dorsal aspect of the foot where the shoe is rubbing or constricting the skin, and they kind of get these almost like calluses, but this is more of a scar tissue type formation. It's a soft connective tissue that differs from calluses, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. Usually you treat these by protecting them, taking off the weight of the friction element from that, taping around them. You can use donut holes. We can also put steroidal injections right into these lesions, and that usually helps the inflammation go down and these will resolve. And most of these will resolve once whatever the offending activity is stopped. And they usually go away on their own. It takes a couple of weeks to months, but resolve spontaneously. Black heel, talon noir. Basically, these are petechiae, which are small blood vessels that have burst. This is a coalition of these blood vessels, and so although it looks rather ominous, this is not something that's a very bad prognosis. It's basically a bruise or a hematoma inside the layers of the skin, right under the epidermal layer. can be caused by the shear forces, usually when runners are running up or down hill, or I'm sorry, up or down hills, and have heavy heel strikes. Self-limiting resolve after the activity is going on, and you don't really have to do much for them when they're there. They're usually asymptomatic, no issues. If you have somebody that continues to get these over and over and over, things that we may try, cushioned heel cups, felt patches, cushioned socks, anything that can prevent the formation of those petechiae, which is basically blood vessels that have ruptured. Subungual hematoma. These are very common. We see these very frequently. It can be from a deceleration. We typically see these in big toe, the first toe. You can see them in fingers, usually from a crush type injury, but in the toes, it's from a rapid deceleration and the toe hitting the front of the shoe. What that does is it causes a little bit of a negative potential space under the nail and breaks the blood vessels, and then you have an accumulation of blood under the nail. What happens with these is as the blood starts, it starts bleeding underneath the nail, it becomes a high pressure bleeding source. If you think about how high your blood pressure goes and that's kind of going through there, filling up that cavity. When the athletes have these, they feel like their nail is throbbing, immense pressure, really, really hurts. One thing that we typically do is if you don't have a cautery pin or heat, then we can use just a sharp 18-gauge needle and basically use it like a little drill. You touch the needle to the tip of the nail, and you just kind of spin it back and forth, and as it cuts through, right as soon as it gets through that layer, like the bottom picture there, the pressure will push the blood out and relieve the pressure, and they usually feel a lot better right afterwards. Once it's open, you want to kind of clean it off, cover it, and make sure that you don't get any kind of infection under there, because that can actually, if you get infection under the nail, that'll cause the patient to lose the nail, or the athlete, sorry, to lose the nail completely, and can actually cause a pretty severe infection. So once it's released, the hematoma is drained, cover it up, keep it clean, and then they're good to go. One thing to recognize is that not all, these are very common things. Occasionally we will see rare occurrences. You can have melanomas underneath the nails. So if there's something like this and it doesn't resolve and it's going into the nail bed or the proximal nail fold, if you're looking at the nail, now see, can y'all see the pointer? No? Yes. So right here on that proximal nail fold, if it's going into the nail fold and that's starting to change color, that would be something I would refer on to a physician, dermatologist, anything like that to kind of get further workup, because there are episodes of melanomas that can be under the nail, subungual melanomas, and those are a serious condition that I don't need to belabor how serious cancer is, but those are things to watch out for. Blisters, again, another common thing, things that we see fairly frequently. It's usually a vesicle or bulle, like I said, once they get very big, with serosanguinous fluid, repetitive pressure or friction on a wet surface is the cause. So when you mix friction with moisture, that's usually where these occur. Typically, we want to manage these closed. I don't know how many I've seen that, hey, you got a blister, take off everything and let's go. But ideally, the skin will provide a good barrier, and if you can release some of that fluid, instead of peeling off the whole thing like this picture shows, if we can make a small hole on the side, get the fluid out, and reapproximate the skin. So again, you're seeing the separation of the dermal layer and the epidermal layer. If we can reapproximate those, keep the skin on there, it'll actually serve as a pretty good barrier. So typically, we want to manage these closed. If they're big, we can drain them, but again, leave that skin on there. If they are unroofed, kind of like this one, there's hydrocolloid dressings that we use. One of the brand names is Duoderm. There's other dressings out there that will basically kind of keep that area protected while it heals underneath. Looking at the footwear, looking at where they're rubbing, those are the types of things that we're going to use to prevent them. Again, if they're rubbing on the heel, maybe adding some tape, adding some a little bit of cushioning there. And again, moisture wicking socks, things that are going to keep the moisture off the skin as much as possible. to keep that from happening. You can also use Vaseline, anti-chafing cream, those types of things. Corns and calluses. Like we talked about before with the athletic nodules, these are a little bit more on the palmar plantar surfaces of the feet. You're going to see these with high content of keratin. So basically, these are the skin cells that are growing over in order to cushion a repetitive trauma that's been going on. We see them in weightlifting, anything where you're going to have pressure on those bony parts of either the hand or the foot, and they can occasionally cause pain depending on where they're at. Let's see. We think we talked about most of that, but the prevention obviously is going to be redistribution of the weight. If they're going to be on the feet, donuts or the little donut-shaped cushions are very useful. They help out in redistributing the weight there. Metatarsal pads can also help redistributing the weight for the plantar calluses. If they get out of hand, they can be pared down surgically. It's something that we can do in the office, and usually it doesn't cause any pain, it doesn't keep them out of any competition or anything like that. Sometimes athletes don't want you to take off the calluses because it actually gives them an advantage. They can run a little bit harder, lift a little bit more weight without having too much damage to the hands or feet. But occasionally they can become painful, so we can take care of them if we need to. Ingrown toenails. This is usually it happens because of improper cutting of the toenails or damage to the toenail, or the shoes are too tight. So what happens, you can see on the lateral side of this nail, you can see that the nail was cut at an angle. I think they were trying to let it grow out, but what happens is that you get a little ridge on the side that instead of growing straight like the nail should, it ends up growing sideways down into the nail fold. These are very, very painful. What we typically will do is we will try to get the little lateral nail fold out without doing too much. You can use soaks of warm water, Epsom salt, that type of stuff. If you can get a piece of cotton, a cotton ball, a Q-tip, anything like that, a piece of dental floss, anything under that lateral nail edge and keep it from going under the skin so it'll grow out, then those will usually resolve. Once they get to something like this where they're hot, they're painful, it's going to be really hard to do that without at least doing a wedge resection. And so the picture on the bottom is typically what we will do in office once all the conservative measures have failed. We will numb up the toe. We do a good regional block of the toe. And then we take out, this is an example of a wedge resection. So if this is just one side of the toenail, this can be done. And we take out that whole offending lateral edge. I will usually give athletes one chance of having this done before I chemically kill the nail where I'm taking this out. It takes about 9 months for the nail to grow back. It's not a spectator sport. It's something that takes a long time. So we'll let the nail come back. If they continue to have these ingrown nails, then once we do it again, then I will use a chemical to kill the matrix on that part. And again, the nail looks normal because most of it is underneath the nail fold. But I usually give them one chance to do it without the matrixectomy. Covered most of the piece on most of the information on that slide. We can move on. Jogger's nipples. We see this if anybody covers long distance running events, marathons, those types of things. This is something that's very common. Usually by cotton fabrics that once people have been running for a long period of time, they get really heavy, really abrasive. We see it mainly in men because women wear sports bras and they're a little smarter than we are. And so men have this quite frequently. You'll see it on marathons around midway point to the latter stations. They'll actually have people with Vaseline that can help coat the nipples to prevent the chafing. What can you do to prevent it? Band-Aids. They have breast padding, a double layer of fingernail polish, anything like that to make a barrier to prevent that chafing. Once it's happened, it's painful, people don't like it. but you just basically take care of it just like any other friction burn. You can use steroid creams if necessary, and that can sometimes help with the inflammation. Pathogenic papules. These are something that I've started seeing more commonly. I think people are just coming to me that they've noticed things, and hey doc, I've got something on the side of my foot, what is this? And basically what happens is you've got a natural band of tissue around the heel, and when you have a little herniation or a little hole in that, some of the subcutaneous fat that everybody has in their feet starts to push through, and it creates these little papules. They're only visible when the patient or athlete is weight-bearing, so they have to be standing up, putting pressure on that to cause the fat to protrude. And visibly, they say something is going on. Usually, they're asymptomatic. Occasionally, you can catch one of the little dermal nerves, and they can be painful. If that were the case, you can use anti-inflammatories. We can do a small little steroid injection to help the inflammation. But these are usually asymptomatic, usually not a big deal. You can use some padding, compression stockings, taping, heel cups. Those types of things can reduce some pain if they have it. But like I said, usually these are not very painful. Rower's rump. If anybody takes care of any rowing teams, any weekend warriors that go to the gym always using the rowing machine doesn't have a good butt pad on it, then you start getting something like this. And basically that's a thickening of the skin. It's hard to tell in the pictures that's projected, but this is called basically like a lichen simplex chronicus, and the skin turns almost bark-like. If you think of the bark of a tree, that's kind of what the skin will look like. And it's just, again, caused by repeated friction in the area. Usually changing the pad on the rowing machine will help out. Occasionally we'll use topical steroids to thin out the skin. And that will usually go away again once the offending exercise is discontinued. Runner's rump. Now, I couldn't find a really good picture of this, but basically this is a bruise. Everybody knows what a bruise looks like, but runner's rump is a bruise right in the gluteal cleft. And I use this picture just to kind of illustrate the differences in the color, because you can see the dark purples, you can see the reds, and the runner's rump is like that kind of section on the top, maybe about 10, 11 o'clock or so, where it looks kind of just a little spot. And what it is basically bruising from, again, long-distance runners, where the gluteal cleft is rubbing and causing rupture of those little blood vessels. Usually asymptomatic, it may be a little bit tender, but it resolves once they stop running for a little bit. So those are the mechanical types of injuries that are commonly seen. We'll move on to some of the environmental stuff. Looking at sunburn, again, this is probably very, very important for everybody here this weekend. Sunburn, there's multiple different wavelengths of UV light. UVA, UVB are the ones that are important for this kind of injury. UVA, and I have the wavelengths there, and there's no test and nothing, that's not really important, just knowing that UVA and UVB are different. But UVA is not very damaging. It's not the one that's going to burn you. It's not very very acute, but it penetrates the skin pretty good. So it has more penetration and causes more chronic skin damage. If you've seen the beach bums that are 50, 60, 70 years old and their skin kind of looks leathery, that's the UVA, the chronic skin damage. Once you get to the UVB, that's the where you're going to turn tomato red. Really painful, blistering, sometimes you get edema or swelling. And things to keep in mind that the UV radiation or UV exposure increases as you go higher in altitude. There's less atmosphere to contend with, so the UV radiation will get to you. And then just because it's cold and snow outside doesn't mean that there's no UV radiation. It bounces right off the white snow. And it's actually a lot stronger off of snow and water and those types of surfaces. Prevention, usually keep from training between the hours of 10 and 2. If you have to, then you can use some sunblock that has some PABA in it. It's the para-aminobenzoic acid. big long words that really just, it's a chemical that keeps the sun from damaging the skin. You want to do it 20 minutes prior to exposure, and then you want to reapply after about every hour and a half, or profuse sweating, or immersion in water. And again, that's in an effort to prevent the damage to the skin from happening. Once it's happened, all you do is time. You can do some of the cooling creams, sometimes aloe vera, some of the creams like Eucerin, some of those can really help with the pain. Topical steroids will also help with the pain and the inflammation, but again, usually time will take care of this. Miliaria rubra. So this is like the typical heat rash. If anybody's heard of the heat rash, we probably get a lot of it down here. It occurs in hot, humid environments. It's very pruritic, itchy, very erythematous, so it turns red. It's a vesiculopapular, and so basically what it is there are small little vesicles that you can see that happens over the where the sweat glands are, usually where it's covered by the clothing. This will spare the hands and the feet, and it's usually treated by getting the athlete out of the sun, out of the heat, get them into a cool environment, and this will go away on its own. Again, hydrophilic ointments, the Eucerin type creams, topical steroids, those can help open these occluded ducts, and we can get this to go away even quicker, but it's usually a self-limited condition. Solar urticaria. So when we think of urticaria, think of hives. So urticaria, hives, solar hives is basically an itching, burning of the skin right after exposure to UV radiation. You're going to have formation of erythema and wheals, so redness in the wheals that show up. And they usually go away within 2 hours. So this is not quite an allergic reaction, but it's very similar to allergic type reaction to UV radiation. Recommend phototesting in order to determine what type of radiation causes it, what kind of treatment is needed. But that should be done, in a dermatologist's office. So we can isolate what type of radiation it is. Again, treatment, avoiding training out in the sun, using sunscreen, high-dose antihistamines, cyclosporin, chloroquine. Chloroquine, I don't know if anybody's ever taken that. It's not a good medication. Lots of GI side effects. IVIG is intravenous immunoglobulin. Again, nobody wants to get an IV infusion because of this. So these are some of the ways we can treat it, but it's not something that I would jump to right away. Cholinergic urticaria is a little bit different. Again, similar in that it's a pruritic dermatosis. Basically, it happens during exercise. It can happen because of heat. It can happen because of stress. It can happen because you had some spicy food. Anything that's going to make your sympathetic system, if you think of the fight or flight, stuff, the fight reflexes, those types of things are going to cause this to occur. They're very small pinpoint papular wheals, so if you rub your hand over the skin, you're going to be able to feel them. It's almost like a little bit of a sandpaper type feel. And this is something that, again, we should be able to test them, but you want to test them in a controlled environment because this could potentially be a precursor to exercise-induced anaphylaxis. That's something we'll talk about it towards the very end, but a very serious condition. So if they have something like this and it tends to occur, get them tested again in a controlled environment. This can be treated with antihistamines, the histamine receptor 1 antihistamines, which is hydroxyzine, that's a prescription-type medication, or cetirizine, that's over-the-counter Zyrtec. Those medications can help alleviate this. Sometimes if they have this, we'll usually tell the patients to take a warm shower the night before either competition or practice or whatever they're going to be doing the following day. That hot shower will increase their sympathetic tone. This will actually happen at night. They can sleep it off. And then their body goes into a refractory period where it can't physiologically happen again while they're doing their exercise. And so it gives them that kind of little free period in order to do their competition. Sometimes this can be exacerbated if the patient is taking aspirin. It can make these a little bit worse. So we moved from hot, now we're going to cold. I'm down here in South Texas. I don't deal a lot with this, but for those that may be coming from a little bit further north than we are right now. Chilblain, also known as pernio, this is an injury that happens from prolonged exposure to cold. Now, this is not freezing temperatures. These are sub-freezing temperatures. I'm sorry, these are just above freezing temperatures, but it's a long period of time. So what happens is basically you have this discoloration of the foot. You can have this reddish-bluish type discoloration. And then once it starts warming up, they can have blistering and then have ulcers. This is due to damage of the blood vessels from the prolonged exposure to the cold. So what happens in the cold, your body is trying to keep all the blood centrally, and so it starts constricting the blood vessels in the periphery. So the ones that get affected the most, toes, fingertips, nose, those types of things, because blood is being shunted to the central circulation. Areas should be rewarmed. Again, you want to prevent any further cold exposure. You do not want to massage these. With any of the cold injuries that we're going to talk about, when you're warming them, you don't want to rub them. I know friction, okay, we can rub it, make it warm. You don't want to rub these because the tissue is already damaged. As we start rubbing, you can start separating tissue layers, and you cause a lot more damage that way. So if you have a cold type injury, rewarm them. You can use flowing water, that kind of stuff, but no manual massage because you can further damage the tissues. Steroids can sometimes minimize the pain, inflammation in the lesions. In order to prevent this, I mean, I think it's almost common sense, but wear gloves, wear insulated clothing, try to keep the extremities and the digits warm and keep them from the exposure to these chronic cold temperatures. Moving on from that, we go into FrostNet. This is what we would typically see. A lot of people say, oh, I got frostbite. They didn't really get frostbite. We'll see pictures of that in just a second. What they typically have is FrostNip. And so what happens is you got the superficial part of the skin that's involved. Tissue becomes white. It can be painful. They can develop paresthesia. So basically they're having a lot of pain sensation in the fingers. They can have loss of sensation. So they're feeling pain. They can't really feel, touch, those types of things. Again, completely reversed with rewarming, although those paresthesias that we talked about, those can last for several weeks. Those can take a long time to resolve. Again, prevent with insulated clothing. Don't shave prior to cold exposure, because what that does is takes off some of the natural oils that the skin has, and the oils act as a protective barrier from the cold. And then again, using petroleum-based emollients will also kind of help keep some of that moisture and warmth in. So when you have FrostNip and it keeps going, gets a lot worse, then you run into frostbite. And frostbite occurs usually when the tissue temperatures fall below 28 degrees, 2 degrees centigrade, for anybody that uses the Celsius meter. Fluid both inside and outside the cell actually freeze, and so the cell membrane ends up dying. So what happens is you get cell death. You can see in that picture, let me see, on your left, the fingertips are discolored. If you were able to feel them, the tissue is cold, it's hard, and usually they don't have any pain. The nerves are frozen, everything's frozen, they can't feel anything, everything is numb. Once you start warming them up, and the management for frostbite is you're going to immobilize the digits, whatever has the frostbite injury, get them out, get them evacuated from wherever they're at. Again, this is usually going to be mountain climbing. You're going to be stuck in bad weather, that kind of stuff. This happens. Again, frostbite is not as common as the FrostNip. But evacuate them, get them away from the danger. You don't want to start rewarming them and then have the tissue freeze again. Again, that will cause more damage. Same thing with the FrostNip, same thing with the Chilblain. Don't rub them, don't massage them. When you rewarm the tissue, it's just going to be running warm water, those types of things. Once this area starts being thawed, that's when they start having pain. The nerve endings are starting to get the feeling back. This pain is extremely excruciating. If you think, the fingers basically just died. So the fingers are going to be very, very painful. We will usually use opioid medication in order to get them through this. And then recovery from this is delayed. You can see there in the picture in the middle that the tissue that has already died is just starting to kind of get black and kind of shrivel up. And then about 2 to 3 months after the injury, once the tissue planes have identified themselves, you know which tissue is viable, which tissue is not, then that's when you go and have surgery. And again, remove the dead tissue, close up the viable tissue, and then that's what you have left. So again, frostbite is very serious. It's one of those things that thankfully I don't see very often. So cold urticaria, like we said, urticaria, you think of hives. It's a reaction to the cold. So you can have these pruritic wheals that show up, usually confined to the exposed area that's been cold or been exposed to cold. We recommend provocative testing, and that's the picture that I showed you here. If you think of an ice cube that we put on the patient's skin, ice cube was placed there, and everywhere that the ice touched and the water was melting and running down, that all raised up like a little hive that kind of was itchy. And so again, that gives us our diagnosis. We recommend avoiding the exposure to the cold, and you can use oral antihistamines if need be, if you're going to be in the cold, in order to try to prevent some of these skin manifestations. So those are the thermal injuries or environmental injuries that are, again, some more common than others. And we'll move on to infectious injuries. Doing okay on time. The first one that we'll talk about is impetigo. So impetigo, it's a serosanguinous, honey-colored crusted, and in medicine we like to describe everything as food because that's the only thing that everybody can agree on as far as color. So we describe everything as food, I guess. So honey-colored or honey-crusted pustules on an erythematous base, so basically just that honey crust on a red base. It's usually a strep-type infection. Common among contact sports, anywhere where you have those abrasions that we saw in the beginning, anything where you have any small injuries in the skin where the strep bacteria can get in and take hold, it can cause something like this. Recommended treatment is both topical antibiotics and oral antibiotics, and usually about 10 days. As far as the NCAA the requirement is that they can't have any new lesions for 2 days, and they have to be treated with antibiotics for 3 days before going back into competition, because these are very, very contagious. So these got to be covered. So once you think of impetigo, strep, that topical skin infection, that honey-colored crusted lesions, strep infections. When we think of staph, staph is the next one. Furunculosis, these are hair follicles, that get occluded. So if you think of pimples, this is basically kind of what's going on, except it's that hair follicle instead of the sweat glands. So again, these are usually a staph or strep type organism, and culture of these is usually pretty common. We'll culture them, we usually grow staph, and it's usually, hopefully, methicillin sensitive, Staph aureus or MSSA. But we've seen a big increase in MRSA, and I don't think it's just locally. I think that's kind of a national type thing as MRSA starts becoming more prevalent. Usually, these will require incision and drainage due to poor hematogenous spread of the antibiotics. So basically, when you're taking the oral antibiotics, the antibiotic goes through your system, taken in the blood, but the blood cannot penetrate the little capsule of these. These are small little abscesses, but it can't penetrate the capsule, and so those don't get any better. You've got to open them up, you've got to drain them, and once the pus comes out, they usually resolve. Same guidelines as before, no new lesions in 2 days, and they've got to be on antibiotic treatment for 3 days. Pitted keratolysis, this is usually on the bottom of the foot, and this can be confused with athlete's foot. This is not athlete's foot. These are small little pits. If you think of little divots on the bottom of the foot, they're described as a scallop-bordered plaque, usually pits, different depths on the pits, and it's on the weight-bearing surfaces. This is caused by a gram-positive bacteria, and it's made worse by excessive sweating. So, athletes are sweating all the time, but if you've got somebody that's excessively sweating, feet are always wet, I mean, when they take off their shoe or their cleat, I mean, they can literally pour water out. That's something that may be a predisposing factor to something like this. Usually, these can be treated with topical-type antibiotics, but they take quite a while. You see there, it's 2 to 4 weeks, so they take a long time to go away. It's not your typical, 5 to 7 days, this is going to go away. These take almost a month of therapy. Erythrasma, it's a different type of infection. It's a chronic type of bacterial infection in the intertriginous areas, basically anywhere where skin is rubbing. You see it in the axilla, you see it in the groin, you see it kind of in the gluteal cleft, those types of things. It's called erythrasma, and erythema is red or redness, but it's not red, it's kind of a brownish color. The reason why it's called erythrasma is because when you look at it under a Woods lamp, and that's just a fancy black light. We like to make things a lot more complicated in the field of medicine than they actually have to be. It's a black light. Once you put it under a black light, and it'll glow red, and that's where it gets its name, erythrasma, from. It's a gram-positive rod, it's the corneal bacterium, and I'm not even gonna try that last part, but it's a sharply demarcated brownish-red lesion. Usually topical antibiotics will take care of this, but we'll do topical and orals for about 2 weeks. And then again, area should be covered prior to participation, because again, this is a bacterial infection, this is contagious, so just kind of keep it covered up. MRSA, this is kind of relates to the other slide, the furunculosis. MRSA, it's the methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. We think about this organism anytime you see something like this, a boil. It's your infamous spider bite. I got bit by a spider. I always got bit by a spider. That's kind of typically what you hear from these. Definitive treatment for this is incision and drainage. Just like we talked about before with the other ones where the antibiotic goes through the blood, it doesn't really penetrate the capsule of this abscess. So once you get the pus out, these usually go away or clear up rather quickly. Prevention, again, includes hygiene. You can use antibacterial soaps, Hibiclens, those types of things, and avoiding cosmetic shaving. Again, cosmetic shaving, any kind of shaving, actually is going to give you small micro abrasions in the skin, causing openings for these bacteria to get in. So again, recommend against that. Antibiotics are usually necessary if there's going to be some cellulitis. Now, it's not too bad on this one, but if you can kind of picture where the little lump is, and that surrounding redness. The infection that goes into the skin or the cellulitis part, if you feel around there and it's hard, I mean, it feels really, really hard. If you start having cellulitis along with the abscess, then that's when we start treating with antibiotics, as opposed to just cutting it open and letting it go. We'll still cut it open, but we'll treat with antibiotics for that surrounding redness or the cellulitis. MRSA, the reason why it gets its own slide is it can be very, very, one, it's very contagious, and it can be a very, very severe infection. MRSA loves to go down to bone. If it gets in the bone, you can get a pretty bad infection. Again, that's a big surgery. You're having washouts. It's IV antibiotics. It's a big ordeal. So MRSA is nothing to joke around with. Get these treated, or should I say evaluated and treated, right away to keep them from kind of spreading. Verruca, common warts caused by the HPV virus. Usually they're going to have these small black dots, and again, I don't know that these are going to show you too well. It's not projecting as well as it looks on a smaller screen. But in the middle of the warts, if you can think about it, that there's these small little black dots in there. Basically what those are the small capillaries that get thrombosed. So basically blood clots in those little capillaries, and that gives the warts their common or their typical appearance. That's kind of what we use in order to say, okay, yes, that is a wart. During the season, we can use the compound W, the salicylic acid. That stuff is over the counter. What it does, it just basically irritates the skin, and it gets the body to identify that as a pathogen. Once the season is done, we're not worried about that. We can do cryotherapy, basically using either liquid nitrogen or a different medication that will actually kind of just freeze the skin as well. But we don't want to do that during competition or if they've got something big coming up, because what that does is, again, it basically just kills that skin. The body recognized that something was there. It attacks the virus and the wart, and then it kind of clears it up. But they can be left with a small little sore from where the cryotherapy was done. So usually save that for after their sports are done. And NCAA requirements, these need to be covered up prior to competition. Molluscum contagiosum. These are small flesh-colored little papules with the characteristic look of these is this little small pearly papule with this umbilicated center, so the little dot right in the center. And that's, when you see that, that's how we usually make the diagnosis of this, the molluscum contagiosum. It's caused by the pox virus. This is highly contagious. It spreads through direct skin contact. It can have spread in water. It can spread in from water and also gym equipment. So again, very contagious. Typically self-limiting, takes a couple of weeks to months to resolve, and it usually goes away. These can be treated with liquid nitrogen, just like we do the warts, topical retinoin or electrodesiccation. Electrodesiccation is just getting either a hyphricator, which is a small cautery device that we use in the office, or a cautery pen, and just burning the lesions. Imiquimod is a medication that it's almost like a chemical peel, and so what it does is it just damages the skin and kind of makes it all peel off. NCAA requirements, again, these lesions, if they're wrestling, if they're going to be in contact with other athletes, these need to be removed with sharp curettage, so we either need to cut them off or we need to use liquid nitrogen to get rid of them, and then they cover the area with an occlusive dressing. Again, very, very contagious. Herpes, herpes gladiatorium. Herpes has this similar look. It's going to be these pustules or vesicles, I should say. This is usually the HSV-1. I'm not sure how familiar everybody is, but herpes simplex virus. There's 1 and 2. Number 1 is usually the oral lesions, sores. This is HSV-1. Genital herpes is HSV-2, so it's not the same thing. Similar virus, but different strains. And herpes is the typical presentation is something like this. It's a cluster of these vesicles. They're extremely painful. They've had that red base to them. And usually, if we see something like this, I can say, okay, that's herpes. I don't need to do any other testing. There are Sank smears and viral PCRs and those types of things that we can do to confirm these if we have a question. But if you see something like this, that's herpes. Viruses pass by direct contact. Usually we will give athletes antiviral medications, acyclovir, Valtrex, those types of things. Dosing is age dependent, and we've got some high school trainers, we've got some collegiate trainers, and there's a little bit of a difference in the way herpes is treated from the pediatric population, so anybody under the age of 18, as opposed to adults. In pediatrics, they're treated for about 7 to 10 days with acyclovir. In adults, it's about 5 days. But what the NCAA says that you can't have any new lesions within 3 days, and you have to have been on antiviral therapy for at least 5 days prior to going back into competition. If you have an athlete that's got cold sores, those types of things, or they've had something like this and they just keep getting these outbreaks over and over and over, they can be put on daily acyclovir. As a prophylactic type medication. And so what we typically do is we start that before the season starts and keep them on it through the season. And then once their season's done, they kind of come off of the prophylactic medication. Tinea pedis, good old athlete's foot. Papulosquamous fungal infection. It's very, very itchy. It can be red, scaly, usually in between the toes or on the lateral sides of the feet, caused by several different types of dermatophytes. Again, I didn't feel like it was necessary to list them because I don't think their names are important, but just knowing that it's several different fungal type infections that can cause this. Majority of them respond to topical antifungal cream. So you think about your Lotrimins, your terbinafine, your tenactin, all the Lamisils, those types of things. Those are typically enough to get rid of athlete's foot. Again, not something that goes away in a matter of days. It's a couple of weeks that it takes, but usually those resolve. If they don't, we can move to oral antifungals, but that's, again, usually bumping them way up the chain. Tinea corporis, so again, still a fungal infection. Anytime we have a fungal type infection, it's usually labeled a tinea type infection. So you had tinea pedis, athlete's foot or a fungal infection on the foot. Tinea corporis, fungal infection on the body. Now, tinea corporis can include either the body, the trunk, also the head. And once it gets up into the head or the scalp, it's treated a little bit differently, and we'll kind of differentiate those here on this slide. But the dermatophyte infection, again, annular lesion, so kind of that circular lesion with that red border on the outside, sharply demarcated, red, scaly, with central clearing. So you see that red portion on the outside, you think of like a typical ringworm type infection, that type of appearance. Those are very common for fungal infections. Treated with topical antifungals, depending on the location. If it's on the body, we can treat with topical antifungal. If it's on the head, it's gotta be oral. And the head antifungals, that's gonna be like about a month, 4 weeks, 6 weeks. Those are long therapies for scalp fungal infections. And that's just because the scalp, the blood supply in the scalp, the vessels are very large, but they don't get a lot of spread of that medication. So we gotta keep them on oral medication for quite a long time. So again, scalp lesions require oral therapy. As far as the NCAA is concerned, 3 days of topical therapy for skin. You've got to be on oral antibiotics for 2 weeks if you've got any kind of fungal infection in the head before returning to competition. And all lesions need to be covered. Tinea cruris, jock itch. Very similar, again, similar presentation. Most of the tinea is going to present with this type of presentation, that kind of ring-looking lesion, well demarcated, scaly borders, usually in the groin, upper thighs, abdomen, genitalia are usually spared. So you're not going to see it on the scrotum, you're not going to see it on the vulva, you're not going to see it on the penis. It's usually just the areas around the groin. Topical steroids may help the symptoms as far as how uncomfortable they are, but these are usually treated with topical antifungals. Again, if there's no improvement with that, we can use oral antifungals, and it's usually something like a fluconazole. It's a one-time oral therapy that's, again, very well tolerated. Tinea versicolor. This is, for me, I think, one of the easiest ones to see. You're going to see it most of the time in our athletes. They're going to have some sort of pigment to them. They've been out in the sun, those types of things. Basically, this M. furfur bacteria, what it does is it absorbs the sunlight. And so while the rest of the skin is getting tan, I guess, that area that the fungus is on doesn't get tan because the fungus has actually absorbed all the sunlight. So you have these hypopigmented areas of the skin. Occasionally, you can see darkening of the skin. But again, you usually will see it this way as opposed to the other way around. Again, wonderful woods lamp, our black light, fancy black light. These will kind of fluoresce yellow-green if you put a black light on them. And again, treating them with selenium sulfide, that's kind of like a Celsin Blue type shampoo, or topical antifungals. If it's very extensive, I mean, they have got it on their back, their legs, their arms, their trunk, everywhere, then we'll just skip straight to oral antifungals and be done with it. Onychomycosis. So again, most common disease of the nails, usually onychomycosis is a fungal infection. Not all ugly nails are fungal infection, but most commonly they are. You can see that the great toe, how you can see the thickening of the nail, the dermatophytes under there. They kind of make it very, very, very thick, as opposed to the second nail that looks rather unscathed. And then the third nail, which is probably in the early signs of the onychomycosis. So you've got like the unaffected nail, early fungal infection, and then late fungal infection that's been going on for a while, and the nail gets very, very thick. Risk factors include nail trauma, moist environment, occlusive footwear, bad circulation. We see this very commonly in our diabetics, and anybody that's on immunosuppressive therapy or they have an immunosuppressed state, then we can typically see something like this. You can use either topical or oral therapy, but what we found out is that if you use both, then you get better resolution. Thing that, like we said, with the ingrown toenails, these take about 9 months to grow out. So if you're doing these antifungal therapies, you're not going to see the nail clear up in a week or two. You're not going to see it clear up in a month or two. You may see the very, very back of the nail clear up in about a month or so. And that's how you know it's working. But again, to get the whole thing out, it's about 9 months, depending on how fast the athlete's nails grow. If we're going to be doing the oral therapy, one thing to kind of keep in the back of your mind, again, more important for the physician, but again, if y'all are taking care of the athletes, they've got to have their liver test monitored, because some of these oral antifungals, since they're going to be on them for such a long time, they can cause their liver function to elevate and have liver issues. So those are the big ones that I meant to cover. We're almost out of time. I've only got a couple more. These I couldn't really fit in, and they just kind of, I figured they bear some mentioning. Contact dermatitis. We can obviously tell what that was from. Somebody's wearing flip-flops on the beach, had an allergy to either the rubber or whatever was in the sandal. But you've got some primary irritant dermatitis. Basically, they're going to have a reaction within minutes to something that they're exposed to. That's not a true allergic reaction. That's an irritant. So if you think of like an acid is going to give you irritation. When you look at the allergic contact dermatitis, that's usually going to be a delayed reaction, usually hours to maybe even days afterwards. You can see it in people that have like nickel allergies or something like that. When they wear something, they wear a necklace with a little pendant. A day later, they have the little circle where the pendant was. So that's an allergic reaction. Let me see if there's anything else that I really need to cover. Some of the common irritants, latex, iodine, poison ivy, tan leather, rubber, rubber coverings in sandals or in athletic wear. Envenomation, those are the two that I think are really important. Wasp, or the family of Hymenoptera, includes wasps, hornets, fire ants, those type of stinging insects. You can use antihistamines and NSAIDs for the allergic reactions that are not anaphylaxis. And I think that every AT or physician that's covering games that has any kind of exposure to outside needs to at least have available an EpiPen, or know where to get one, or have EMS available so they can get Epi administered, because you don't always know who's had a reaction. You only know if they've had one before. And so you don't want to find out that somebody has an anaphylactic reaction and not be prepared. So think about that, either an emergency action plan or something like that, if somebody has this type of allergy, to have Epi available. The other one on the bottom, that's our wonderful diamond head rattler that we've got here in Texas. Venomous snakes. Usually if you have a snake bite, splint the extremity or splint whatever was bitten to keep it from moving. You don't want the muscles contracting, moving the blood around. Don't attempt to put a tourniquet on. Don't cut them and try to suck out the poison. A lot of the things that you kind of hear in the movies and all kinds of stuff like that, venom extractors, electric shock, there's all kinds of things that people have tried for snake bites. Don't do it. What they need is antivenom. So what we do is we splint them, get them to the hospital. We will have the antivenom ready, but we don't give it if we don't need it, because you can have allergic reactions to that as well. So again, get them to a facility where they can be evaluated. And Skype is going on. That's awesome. And then the last one, I think, is this exercise-induced anaphylaxis. We talked about, or I mentioned it earlier. Again, this is basically an anaphylactic reaction that somebody has when they start participating in exercise. It doesn't matter if they're a couch potato, if they're an elite athlete. There's really no predisposition to this type of stuff. Usually it starts with just kind of being itchy all over. Then you start having some of the angioedema, the swelling. You start seeing the swelling of the face. This gets really dangerous when their airway starts swelling up, those types of things. If you start noticing something like this, that's kind of, if you have an EpiPen, give it, transport to the ER right away. If somebody has something like this and they say, you know what, if I go, I go. I want to die doing something that I enjoy. Make sure they've got an EpiPen and they have a running buddy. They've got somebody with them that can that knows how to use it if they're going to continue to exercise, because, again, that can be life-threatening. That's all I got.